As many of you know, that we've been spending this year on the Paramis. This is the third week on the Parami of Metta. Next month is the last Parami in the list of 10, which is equanimity. And then in December, we'll do a review of the year and all the Paramis we've explored. It's been a wonderful year for me anyway in my practice. In the first 2 weeks of this month, two of our newest members to the Sunday team offered talks. They were wonderful, and it just reminds us of how happy we are that they've joined us and we have a larger leadership team. The first Sunday, Nina focused on offering metta to oneself, and she also talked about the many benefits that accrue to those of us who practice it. Judith last week shared her own journey of developing a wholesome and regular metta practice. And for both Sundays, we did some practicing with the phrases. This morning, I'm going to add my effort, to the fullness of our understanding of the Parami of Metta. And I'm basically going to be asking or answering the question in a couple different ways of why do we practice metta? What is metta in service of? There are three that I'm going to talk about. One is the historical description of how the Buddha offered it to the monks as an antidote to fear. Another is the way Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about it as an antidote to the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. And how Sharon Salzberg, who's one of the Westerners who brought Theravadan Buddhism back to this country and is one of the founders of IMS, she describes it as a practice that unites us all. And then we'll actually read out loud the Metta Sutta together and talk a bit about practice. In one of Tim's talks this month on Monday night, which Mike is both in person and online, he told about the circumstances when the Buddha first taught the Metta Sutta. Some of us don't actually believe all the stories told in the suttas about devas and tree deities and the many, many past lives of the Buddha. But the story of the power of the Metta Sutta for the earlier monks can really be seen as inspirational. So here's what happened. So there were 500 monks, and the Buddha instructed them to go and sit in the forest and meditate. And in the original story, there were tree deities who lived in the forest. And at first they welcomed the monks, but then the monks stayed there a really long time. And the tree deities became kind of annoyed because they felt that this was their forest. And so they decided to frighten the monks away. They showed them terrifying objects. They made dreadful noises. And they created a sickening stench. So the monks were all kind of worked up about this. And they went back to the Buddha, frightened and upset. And they asked for a different location. And it said in the story that the Buddha, through his super normal powers, scanned the entirety of India, but found no place except the same place where he had already sent them, where they could achieve spiritual liberation. So he told them to go back to the same forest. And he said, "Fear not. If you want to be free from the harassment caused by the deities, learn this sutta, the Metta Sutta." So all the monks memorized the sutta, and they went back to the forest. The Buddha said it's a theme for meditation as well as a formula for protection. And it is said that the tree deities were so charged with warm feelings of goodwill that they materialized themselves in human form and received the monks with great piety. They looked after the monks in every way. They provided food and water and housing. and they made sure the place was really quiet. And it said in the story that enjoying perfect silence by the end of the rainy season, which was when the monks were meditating, all the monks attained the pinnacle of spiritual perfection. Every one of the 500 monks had become an arahant. The teachings describe the power intrinsic in the Metta Sutta as protective of any who recite it and practice it. And it is said that meditating on metta will not only safeguard one in every way, but will also protect all those around them and will make spiritual progress that can actually be verified. No harm can ever befall a person who follows the path of metta. Wow. So I'm one of those Dharma practitioners who has a bit of difficulty with some of these stories of deities and devas, but I really like this story. The monks were so scared in the forest, and the Buddha said, go back there, and here's your tool. I mean, one could even call it a weapon against these frightening beings who lived in the trees. And I love that the Buddha didn't send him with an actual weapon. I don't know what the weapons were 2,600 years ago, but with an attitude of metta. He instructed them to be friendly towards whatever they found there. And the story says to me that metta can be a really powerful tool for all of us in dealing with life's difficulties. A second way of understanding metta and what it's good for is as an antidote to the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Bhikkhu Bodhi. He's a U.S.-born Theravadan monk. He's a scholar, a writer of many books, and a founder of Buddhist Global Relief. He's very engaged in the world. And here's how he frames metta as part of, he did it as part of the framing of the Brahma Viharas, which are the four divine abodes, and metta is the first and central one. And this is how he describes how they fit into practice. He places them within the theme of the defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. In his words, these drives of greed, hatred, and delusion have brought us into the world of strife and suffering. And it is these same drives that keep the wheel of history turning, erupting periodically in orgies of senseless violence. Those are his words. He describes what the Buddha is offering to us. He says it's a path to freedom that involves crossing the stream of these defilements and getting to the safety of the other shore. One of the essential steps in our effort to reach the other shore, he says, is to, quote, lay down the rod, to put away violence, aggression, and harmfulness towards all living beings. And he goes on to say that developing a mind of harmlessness is found by putting ourselves in the place of another. Just as each of us, in our innermost nature, desire to be well and happy, be free from all harm, danger, and distress, so do all others want the same. He says that we practice to purify our minds of these afflictive states of animosity and cruelty. And we do this through the practice of concentration. And remember how both Nina and Judith talked about the phrases can be an actual concentration practice. So we do this through the practice of concentration, the development of wisdom, living a moral life, the parami of sila, and by developing the antidotes, these divine abodes of loving kindness and compassion. He reminds us that these afflictive mind states of greed, hatred, and delusion live in the deep recesses of the mind. So we undertake this entire practicing on this path in order to extricate the hidden roots of these poisons. The state of the world is a manifestation and reflection of the minds of its inhabitants. That's what Bhikkhu Bodhi says. So our training and practice with the antidotes to the defilements is our contribution to making a change in the state of the world. Practicing with metta and the other Brahma Viharas is a way, well, some might say it's insignificant, but I think not. It's a way of living the antidotes to the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. It can be our gift to the world. It can be a powerful practice. The third approach, or the third discussion of why we practice metta, comes from Sharon Salzberg. She's written a number of books on metta. But before I talk about that, I want to say just a few things, a few words about the various translations of the Pali word metta. Both Nina and Judith talked about finding their own English word that really worked for them and encouraged their practice. Nina said that she found it helpful in her practice to let go of the word loving, as in the definition or translation, loving kindness, and let the remaining friendliness or kindness suffice for her. It sparked words like allowing, softening into, and giving permission. For me, I too do not resonate with the translation of loving kindness. I really like friendliness. And I also like what Christina Feldman defines it as, standing next to. There's one of the ancient, most important teachers in the Zen tradition, Dogen, who said that all of the practice is a growing, deepening sense of intimacy with life. And I think metta can be defined, when it's defined as standing next to, it can be a really integral part of that process of greater intimacy. We stand next to something by choice, not because we're forced to, but because we choose to. We stand next to dukkha. We stand next to those who are different from us. We stand next to the truth of impermanence. We stand next to difficulties. So Sharon Salzberg uses the word love for explaining the Pali word metta. Even though using the word love can be really challenging because of all of its various meanings in English, here is what she says about that. She says, metta is the sense of love that is not bound to desire, that doesn't have to pretend that things are other than the way they are, and it overcomes the illusion of separateness, of not being part of the whole. What unites us, similarly to what Bhikkhu Bodhi said about putting ourselves in the place of another, she says, what unites us as all human beings is an urge for happiness, which at the heart is a yearning for union, for overcoming our feelings of separateness. Metta is the ability to embrace all parts of ourselves, as well as all parts of the world. She goes on to describe that when we feel love, our mind is expansive and open enough to include the entirety of life in full awareness, both its pleasures and its pains. We feel neither betrayed by pain nor overcome by it, and thus we can contact that which is undamaged within us, regardless of the situation. We are whole. Our deepest happiness is intrinsic to the nature of our minds, and it is not damaged through uncertainty and change. She's also quoted as saying, only love is big enough to hold all the pain in the world. All three of these approaches to understanding metta are potent. I think they can be challenging, but they're also aspirational. I'd like to have us spend just a couple moments reciting out loud to ourselves the Metta Sutta. I am going to bring this up and share it. Can people see the Metta Sutta? Oh, yay. So everyone is muted, but I really recommend that you recite this out loud. They're powerful words, and I will read it out loud. Let's just do that. It only takes about 2 minutes. This is what should be done. What's that? Did someone ask something? Okay. Make sure everybody's muted because it'll be weird if we start hearing each other's voices. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they're weak or strong, omitting none. The great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Whew! This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. That's us. That's each of us. How do we become skilled in goodness, and how do we learn and know the path of peace? I think we do it by practicing metta, the other Brahma Viharas, the Four Noble Truths, that we commit ourselves again and again to the truth of the Dharma. Just like we talked about last month with the Parami of Resolve, we set an intention, and we might stumble and fall, but then we get up and start again. We begin, we continue, we start again. Both Nina and Judith encouraged us to find our own authentic relationship with metta and to answer the question, what does it mean for you and how do you cultivate it in your life? What seems so clear from the sutta is that metta is something we practice moment by moment throughout our daily lives. It's not only a specific practice that's included in formal meditation. Whichever perspective or context resonates with you, an antidote to fear, a way of dealing with poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, a practice that strengthens our sense of connectedness, whatever works for you, make the practice alive. Bring that sense of friendliness, standing next to, intimacy to everything you do. The other day, I had a sit where my mind was so unsettled, and I practiced with offering friendliness to that mind. Just a friendly okay, standing next to, receiving, okay, this is a mind that's rattled and unsettled, and just, it felt really good. My mind was still unsettled, but it was a different kind of relationship to it. During Nina's day-long that she offered on metta, people offered metta to the entire planet. In Sharon Salzberg's, one of her books on metta, she says that the Pali word metta has two meanings, gentle, like the rain, and friendly. So nurturing a heart mind that is gentle like the rain, that's friendly, doesn't discriminate or create categories where some are deserving of our metta and others aren't. We just nurture this heart mind in ways that are gentle and soften us. And as we practice with the Metta Sutta, we notice that some of the words are challenging. So we pause and we feel the challenge of it, the resistance of it. What happens when you say out loud, omitting none? What happens? Explore that, investigate it. Seek a greater understanding of what that resistance is. The other thing is to really come up with phrases that are meaningful for you. Both Judith and Lyndall and Nina offer different phrases, and any of you who have been on retreats, you know that there are certain phrases that seem to always be offered. For me, I have practiced for years trying to understand the very first phrase, "May I be safe and protected from inner and outer harm." Finally, this last year, I finally realized that, for me anyway, all harm is inner harm because of what the mind does with the external harm that it notices. But find phrases that are really worthwhile for you, that are meaningful. I woke up the other morning trying to search for a good way to end this talk. And you know, I feel good about sharing those three different ways of understanding metta. And then it came to me that I actually have a fourth way of understanding metta, which is how it has morphed or evolved in my own practice. I had my own difficulty, years of difficulty with metta. But when I finally opened to it, I found that it's become embodied in my life as friendliness. It's become an overall tone, attitude, or one might even say a persona. I have the intention to walk through my world embodying friendliness as best as I am able. And here are some of the ways that it shows up for me. I get frustrated with strangers out and about. They're either driving or riding their bike where they're way too fast. And I try to just understand who they are. In traffic, it's easy because I remind myself that other people are trying to get to where they're going, just like I'm trying to get to where I'm going. I live right across the street from the cycle track, from the Lake Union cycle track, and the bikes go way too fast. And I wish that they would behave differently and slow down, but I can wish them safe passage for them and for others. When I'm confronted with all the lies that come into us through TV and social media, it helps me to recommit to the Dharma and the truth of the way things really are. It reminds me how all of us are a product of conditioning. Every single one of us, you know, families of origin, class, race, original geographical location, all the years of our lives, all the influencers, you can add things to that list. And this friendliness also comes out in the ways that I have these mini chats with strangers as I'm walking around. I don't use any Buddhist words. We just talk about the day, the troubles in the world often comes up. Sometimes people just offer how they navigate a difficult life. Most importantly, my heart feels at ease. Oh, I've got my frets and worries, you know, the election, my own life, the difficulties of people I care about. But I find that offering this attitude of friendliness kind of softens some of those difficulties. And of course, when good things happen, it's really pretty easy to rejoice. And then, you know, when you actually practice with metta and it becomes this all-encompassing attitude, you get an added benefit. You get to dedicate the merit of that you've accumulated from all of this standing next to, from all of this welcoming and softening and being gentle as the rain. So may each of us find a way to soften, to find that friendliness inside of us. And may each of us live with ease. I love the last phrase of the metta phrases that Philip Moffat offers always, and he'll be coming in December. His last phrase is, may each of us know love, joy, wonder, and wisdom in this life just as it is. Thanks everybody for your kind attention, and I know it's not easy to go into discussion groups. Welcome back. People will start showing up. Hi, Maria. Okay, looks like everybody's back. So we have some time for sharing. And I know it's not easy. Not everybody is a talker. I'm a talker, but not everybody is. Know that this is a safe place, that we all receive whatever you have to share with kindness, friendliness, appreciation. So what does metta serve? How does it serve you in your practice or anything else? So you can go down to the bottom of your screen and raise your hand, or you can go like this. And what you got to say, folks? Judith, please.
All right, I'll start. Well, we ended up, as so often happens, talking about the difficult people, and also how sometimes that's us, right? And not even just necessarily are we the difficult people to other people. We probably are at times, but how we are the difficult person to ourselves, and the importance of giving metta to ourselves, and just understanding that. And
thank you. Boy, what a good reminder. I remember years ago at St. Mark's, we had this teacher coming from Tacoma. Her name's Jude Rosin, and she announced to everybody how at a metta retreat she realized that she was at least one person's difficult person, if not more. But I love how you broaden that, Judith, to that there are difficult parts of ourselves that we have a hard time relating to. And what an interesting thing to explore what would happen if we sent a friendlier attitude towards that difficult part of ourselves. And I mean, life is so amazing and so challenging, both. And so here we go, you know, we're doing the challenging, then we do the amazing. And I think that, as I said, that, you know, the gift that has come to me after all those years of struggling with metta is just going, oh, I could just kind of almost wear the cloak of friendliness. What would happen if I walked through my world that way? And what happens if you're sitting by yourself and bring that friendliness internal? I think the Metta Sutta is such a high bar, but it's also grounded. It's also just right here available. So thanks, Judith, for bringing us back to that truth of our own difficulties. Yeah. And, you know, that we want life to be different. We want ourselves to be different. You know, why did I actually say such a thing to that person? Or why do I get so scared about X? Or why? And then there it is. Yeah. So anyone else, how's, you know, does metta serve you? Is maybe you're, like some of us have shared, maybe it's challenging to have that metta practice, or just anything that's up. We got a few more minutes before announcements. Julie, please.
Yeah, it's something that, first of all, thanks, Suze. I always enjoy your talks. And I just, something that just came up a moment ago when you were speaking for me was, I read something in the Breathing Like a Buddha book that Lauren, thank you for making sure I got connected with. But he used an analogy, Ajahn Suchito used an analogy about, he used the word web, as in this web of layers that we impose on ourselves to create who we are, and how the process of meditation, you know, you're slowly looking at them and things, you know, when you're understanding them, they're dissolving. And it just occurred to me that, you know, the only way that that can actually occur is if you're looking at them with eyes of metta. Right. And it also reminded me of something that Arv brought up about the IFS, which a lot of people here know about, the internal family systems, because you were talking about parts of ourselves that we don't like. And it's a therapeutic approach to getting in touch with those aspects of yourself you don't like. And again, the key component is approaching it with friendliness. You know, getting rid of the judgmental self and recognizing that we're all this complex web of personalities that have been developed through conditions that started, you know, before we were born. And I think that for me anyway, it's thinking of it that way is makes it a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So just wanted to share that.
Yeah. Thank you, Julie. We hear all the talks, we practice, we read, and there's this like mental emotional digestion process that happens. And then we find these gems that help us navigate. It's like the Metta Sutta became the tool for the monks. And all the different teachings come together and become those navigational tools for us. And I think it's part of the beauty of the refuge of the Dhamma that, you know, you can almost walk in at any of the Dharma doors and the whole thing opens up. And now we're in the month of Metta, but it could have easily been the month of Sila or Wisdom or Resolve, and they all just, one opens up and then there you are. Anyone else? How are things? We can be quiet. That's okay. Yeah, please, Lyndall, go ahead. You're muted. You got to unmute.
There you go. One of the things that has really helped me to be able to practice metta and feel less resistance to metta is recognizing that, yes, it is a high bar, and it's a high bar for everybody. And so it's okay that we're not always getting it perfect and we're not getting it right. So I've been, realizing that just having the intention to bring a friendly attitude towards ourselves, towards others, to whatever is in the world, that is a pretty big thing. And to remember, that offering metta to people that we don't know, that are difficult, it's understood that it's hard. Mm-hmm. And so that's helped me a lot to not get down on myself for saying, I can't do this, I'm not good enough, I'm not kind enough, but just offer, bring that attitude, do the best I can, mm-hmm. and that's enough. So I think that has helped me a lot to actually engage with the practice.
It's such a beautiful reminder, as best we are able. And then also the sharing from resolve. You begin again, then you resolve to continue, you resolve to begin again, you resolve to, pick yourself up when you've fallen down, and not to minimize how important it is that we have these relationships with other Dharma friends. When things are rough, reach out and, hey, everybody understands it. It's just like what you said, Lyndall, that it's a high bar for everybody. It's not like you look around and, oh, that person just is easy peasy. Nothing, no problem, I don't know anybody like that. So, yeah. One last comment, yes, Lauren, please mute yours, unmute.
Quickly, we talked about your sharing about the standing next to in our group, and I remembered Tim asking me to sit next to myself, I believe it was. And there's a body softening just by being present next to. And empathy is so much an important part of metta that I personally, my experience in just sitting next to without giving any necessarily, with any kind of eyes or anything, it's just like a first step in getting towards metta and accepting and embracing. So I just wanted to bring that up.
What a lovely way of ending the conversation part. That first step of just sitting next to whatever is difficult. Body, mind, community, world. We just take that first step. Thanks, Lauren. I so appreciate all the wisdom that shows up in our lovely Sangha. So let me just do a couple announcements here.